There's a lot of counselors these days that are trained in solution-focused brief therapy. So the idea behind this is that rather than spending a lot of time talking in depth about the problems, our conversation should be about what we can do to bring about change. So when I was thinking about this, I spent some time talking with other Christians that I work with, and I said, I'm going to be going and I'm going to be talking to this group of people, and I'm going to be talking to them about what I think they should be praying for. So I said, well, what do you think I should tell them to pray for? And there was this older guy that I asked. I had a couple of conversations, but this older guy, he was like, tell them to pray for salvation. And I was like, it kind of took me back for a second, because I'm like, yeah, that's what we should be praying for people. So then the question becomes, what's that going to take? Not on their part, but on our part. A solution-focused prayer would not be asking God to fix other people. It would be asking God to show you what you can do to change a problem. And I really was putting some thought into this, and had, some other stuff going on in my own kind of walk. And I just kind of had this image in my head that, we're kind of surrounded by this dried-out valley. And in this valley, there's a lot of people that think they have life, but they really don't. They don't understand. They know that they have failure, and they know they have fear, and they know they have pain. They know they have hopelessness, but they don't really understand that that's a symptom of being dead in their sin. They don't really even have the language for that. So what do we need to do to fix that? I want to read you a story. This came out of a newspaper that came to our house. So probably some of you have read this. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read part of it. It's from an April 26th Community Shopper newspaper. It says, Allegheny County District Attorney says heroin directly provided to overdose victims. Belmont. The Allegheny County District Attorney's Office is continuing its prosecution of two people accused of supplying fatal doses of heroin to two men who died, and plans to continue charging dealers with homicide in the future. The Assistant District Attorney recently provided his first public comments since charging a Bolivar woman and a Cuban man with homicide last month in connection to two recent heroin overdoses. The New York State Police, in cooperation with the DA's office, charged both of these two individuals on March 22nd with criminally negligent homicide, a Class E felony, and third-degree criminal possession of a controlled substance, a Class B felony. The one individual from Bolivar is alleged to have provided heroin to a 24-year-old from Bolivar who died March 7th in Clarksville. The other individual from Cuba is alleged to have been involved in providing heroin to a 30-year-old man from Wellsville who died February 28th in Wellsville. State police previously said similarities between the narcotics in both of the deaths led to the revelation that another individual was involved in supplying the heroin. And that individual's attorney from Lackawanna, he denies the involvement of his client. He says that his client doesn't even know the victims. And the quote says, he doesn't know them from a hole in the wall. I don't see any connection to my client and to the death of this kid. He's completely innocent. So when you read something like that, I just would challenge you to pay attention to what kind of emotions you feel. Because I think it's easy to feel angry. But the Bible tells us that as God's chosen people, we need to clothe ourselves in compassion. And from Jesus' ministry on earth, we see him offer compassion to the harassed, the helpless, the sick, the blind, the hungry. And I think it's easy in situations like this to think that these people aren't quite so deserving of compassion, because obviously they made some choices to bring heroin into our county and to sell it, to use it. But these folks also have parents. They may have spouses, they might have children. And those children are home tonight while their parents are in jail for negligent homicide. That's now part of their story that they'll carry with them the rest of their life. The story about compassion that I think is most applicable here is the parable of the prodigal son. Because the prodigal, by any measure, he chose to be in the situation he was in. Those were his choices, to take his money and to leave and to spend it. And he was dirty and hungry and embarrassed and helpless. But when he came back, his father had compassion for him. I looked up on a Bible dictionary website what compassion means. It's the human disposition that fuels acts of kindness and mercy. It's aroused when we're confronted by those who suffer or who are vulnerable. It often produces actions to alleviate suffering. And so I would say the first thing, if you want to set about praying for change in Allegheny County, I would encourage you to ask God to give you compassion for the children who are impacted by stories like this, and compassion for the adults that create stories like this. The other thing that, you know, God's been speaking to me about is about boldness. So 2 Corinthians 3:12, since we have such hope, we are very bold. And in Ephesians 6:19, and also for me, that the words may be given to me in opening my mouth boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel. Boldness, acting by the power of the Holy Spirit on an urgent conviction in the face of some threat. Boldness takes conviction, courage, and urgency. I did get you some statistics here. 28% of the children in this county live in poverty. Half of those homes are headed by a single mother. When families go to Accord Corporation, which is our community action agency, for help, 35% of the time what they're asking for is food. In 2015, for 222 nights, so 222 of 365 nights, there was a victim of domestic violence in a shelter in Allegheny County. And sometimes she would have had her children with her, and sometimes she may not have. In 2015, on an average night, there were 90 children in foster care, 90 Allegheny County kids in foster care, which means that there were conditions in their home that were so dangerous, the county could do nothing to keep them safe in their homes with their families. The jail in Allegheny County has 164 beds. On an average night in 2013, 133 of those beds were full. And so you have to think about the children that were home in their own beds while their parents were in jail. One of five of our eighth graders have thought about suicide. One of five of our 10th graders have attempted suicide. And 30% of all of those kids have engaged in some type of self-injury. In 2014, there were 287 families in Allegheny County that had substantiated reports of child abuse or maltreatment. And when these kids go to school, by the time they're in sixth grade, half of them say they've been bullied, and a quarter of them say that they've bullied someone. So this is a book I read a while ago. It was in the news quite a bit back in like 2016. It's called Hillbilly Elegy. It's the story of a guy who grew up in Tennessee and Ohio from a family, really unstable father figures in and out of the home. His mom was addicted to narcotics. A story that's pretty typical of the stories that I hear working with families in Allegheny County. And I just wanted to read you just a couple paragraphs from the end of this book. He doesn't make excuses for his family. He just kind of tells it. He just kind of tells the story as it happened. But here's what he says about having dinner with he's now out of this situation. He's been in the military, he went to college, and now he's back in his hometown having lunch with a teenager, a 15-year-old teenager named Brian. He says, "Not that long ago, I had lunch with Brian, a young man who reminded me of myself at 15. Like my mom, his mother caught a taste for narcotics, and like me, he had a complicated relationship with his father. He's a sweet kid with a big heart and a quiet manner, and he spent nearly his entire life in Appalachian, Kentucky. We went to lunch at a local fast food restaurant because in that corner of the world, there isn't much else to eat. As we talked, I noticed little quirks that others wouldn't notice. He didn't want to share his milkshake, which was a little out of character for a kid who ended every sentence with please and thank you. He finished his food quickly and then nervously looked from person to person, and I could tell he wanted to ask a question. So I wrapped my arm around his shoulder and asked if he needed anything. Yeah, he started refusing to make eye contact, and then almost a whisper, I wonder if I could get a few more French fries. He was hungry. In 2014, in the richest country on earth, he wanted a little extra to eat but felt uncomfortable asking. Just a few months after we saw each other last, Brian's mom died unexpectedly. He hadn't lived with her in years, so outsiders might imagine that her death was easier to bear. Those folks are wrong. People like Brian and me don't lose contact with our parents because we don't care. We lose contact with them to survive. We never stop loving. We never lose hope that our loved ones will change. But rather, we're forced, either by wisdom or by law, to take a path of self-preservation. So what happens to Brian? He has no grandma or grandpa, at least not like mine, and though he's lucky enough to have supportive family who will keep him out of foster care, his hope for a normal life evaporated long ago. When we met, his mother had already permanently lost custody, and in his short life, he'd already experienced multiple instances of childhood trauma. And in a few years, he'll begin making decisions about employment and education that even children of wealth and privilege have trouble navigating. Any chance he has lies with the people around him, his family, me, my kin, the people like us, and the broad community of hillbillies. And if that chance is to materialize, we hillbillies must wake up. Brian's mom's death was another crappy card in an already abysmal hand, but there are many cards left to deal. Whether his community empowers him with a sense that he can control his own destiny or encourages him to take refuge in resentment at forces beyond his control. Whether he can access a church that teaches him lessons of Christian love, family, and purpose. Whether those people who do step up to positively influence Brian find emotional and spiritual support from their neighbors. I believe the hillbillies are the toughest people on this earth. But are we tough enough to do what needs to be done to help a kid like Brian? Are we tough enough to build a church that forces kids like me to engage with the world rather than withdraw from it? And are we tough enough to look ourselves in the mirror and admit that our conduct harms our children? I'm sorry, I know that was long, but I didn't think that I could say it better than that. So J.D. Vance, who wrote that book, obviously, there's some Christian there's some Christian themes in there, but I think the story and the challenge that he gives us is what we should be praying about. It's so easy to get angry at people, and it's so easy to think that the solution is in holding people accountable. But I've found that that doesn't work very well. The things that I pray about are about compassion, to love people and have mercy for people in all their circumstances, and then also for boldness to open your mouth and share the gospel when you have the opportunity. And then, you know, after that, then the Holy Spirit takes over and he does the rest of the work. So that's all I have to share. I don't know if that was exactly what you wanted, Pastor. I am going to be talking at the Hope Center tomorrow night and Tuesday during the day to talk more about kind of the specific functions of child protective services, working with families. A lot of the work that we do in child protective these days is with families that have drugs, domestic violence, mental illness. They usually come together. You usually see them together in any given family. So I'm going to be talking about that, and also about, you know, all the other kinds of things that get reported to CPS and how we help families with those things. So I'd encourage you to come to that if you'd like to hear more about that specific part of the work. But does anyone have any questions? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I'm watching this whole thing. It's just makes me so sick. You know, they're almost 70, and I got a girl who's 12 or 13. That basically, how do you support the grandparents? Do you find a lot of grandparents are the ones that step in?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So. You know, a generation ago, children that couldn't stay in their homes often went to foster care with a stranger in some kind of certified placement, and there's been a big reverse on that in a very good way, that kids should be left in homes with their family members, if at all possible. Kind of an unexpected consequence of that is that we have a generation of grandparents who are raising children that are very high needs because of what they've experienced in the home with their parents. And then maybe a second consequence that I don't know if it's as well documented yet at this point, but there seems to be potentially less urgency on the part of parents to get children out of foster care when the kids are with relatives. So, you know, for however that motivated people to, you know, if a child was removed from your home, that you needed to, you know, fix whatever the conditions were that put the child in danger so that the kid could come home. When the children are with grandparents or an aunt or uncle, there's less motivation to do that. And so I think one of the challenges of the system, especially now, because we have a generation of children that they were growing up in single family home or single parent homes as it was, and now we have a lot of parents who are, we have children who have been orphaned by opiates in Allegheny County. And we have an opiate addiction isn't something that gets treatment, and we expect that a parent's going to be better and able to return to, you know, all the full responsibilities of raising their kids. The truth is if your parent has a problem with opiates, they may not be able to take care of you for your entire childhood. And so kids living with their grandparents, how are we going to support those grandparents? We don't have an answer for that yet, because it's such a it's such a rapidly growing situation, but I would anticipate it will happen more. I would anticipate as we continue in the opioid epidemic that there will be more and more family members who are going to be the long-term caregivers for children who just can't stay with their parents because of the addiction or because of the jail time. I mean, when you think about, you know, someone who's being charged with negligent homicide, that person's not going to be able to care for their children while the kids are little. They're going to be in jail. So oh, they absolutely can. I think that's one of the changes. So when kids first started getting placed with relatives, there was kind of this feeling of like, oh, they're just going with their grandparents. Great, we don't have to worry about them anymore. And what we found out was is that those placements are actually a lot more difficult than traditional foster care placements, because now the relative not only has to care for this child that's very high needs, but they also have to deal with the relationship with their child, their adult child, who may be angry, who may be trying to take advantage. I mean, it's a very, very difficult thing for a grandparent to have to tell their child, no, they can't have access to their grandchild. And it doesn't get easier. So there's building support. We're trying to find more ways to help those families. I think it would be, you know, definitely the church should be looking to those families and helping them and supporting them. Part of the other problem is, I think, is that the older generation, the grandparents, they don't know how to use the system as well as maybe their children do. So we need to reach out to them and make sure they know how to get support, even things like financial support. It's a very real thing when you take on a grandchild after you've retired. You need money. You need to know how to get health insurance for the child. You need money to pay for it. The things the kid needs, you know. So it's just, you know, you're kind of watching the system change to meet the needs of families because of this epidemic. But certainly they're entitled to all the support that any foster family would have.
Yeah, this grandparent, I happened to talk just this weekend with the granddaughter they're raising, and she pulled me aside and she showed me a bracelet. Basically was telling me I have a secret relationship that they're not controlling or aware of. And I thought, boy, there's that divide between the grandparents not knowing. All of a sudden they have this young kid who's living in a culture that's completely foreign to them because of the generationals. And, you know, it just feels like, as I looked at that, I was like, am I supposed to tell them? You know, but it just made me feel so happy.
Mm-hmm.
For
yeah, I think it's something we got to learn how to help with for sure. Because it's not just that you've got a Gen Zer or whatever who's better at social media than we ever will be. But when you have a child that's already been exposed to drugs, domestic violence, maybe they've seen their parents arrested, they've been removed from their home, they've had a lot of housing instability. Those kids have complex behavior problems. And it takes very skilled people to care for them, you know. And they're growing up, they're going to be the adults and the parents before we know it. And which is part of the reason why I really just think you need to understand that you can't help children without helping their families. There's no way to put a child in a better situation if you're not willing to bring the parents along. Kids and families are not, you can't separate them. And the kids that are so, we look at them and they're so deserving of our compassion and our help today, they're adults before you know it. And it's still the same person. And we can be really angry at the adults. If you understand their stories though, you just think, well, how could it have been any different, you know? That's what I believe. But from a social work perspective, there's so much about Christian faith and membership in a church community that's good for a family. There's so much. There's accountability in your relationships. There's people to come around you to support you. There's people that can, that you have relationships with that can talk to you and tell you when they think that you're, you know, doing something that you shouldn't be doing. Membership in a church community is good for families, even when they're not Christians. And then, you know, but like I said, sometimes I just think these people, we live surrounded by people that don't even know that they're not alive, you know? They have all this pain and all this, these symptoms of death and sin.
And how much are you allowed to guide or direct somebody towards something like that at the county?
Not really. I mean, I think, again, a generation ago, there was really kind of an effort to cut any kind of conversations about faith and spirituality out of kind of secular helping professions. But, you know, in the last generation, at least since I've been a social worker, there's a real recognition that spirituality and faith and connection to a faith community, especially in an area like this, where the church is the support network in this community in a lot of ways. There's nothing wrong with talking with a family about how they cope, how their spirituality helps them cope, who in their community they can turn to, who in their community they know other people have turned to, and to talk with them about building relationships with people in churches. Now, I can't say to someone, the solution to your problem is that you need to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. But I can definitely say Wellsville Bible has a great children's program, and they've got great people there, and you should go. I think you should go check that place out. Let me know how it goes.
So how connect the dots, and how can we, as a church community, make ourselves more known to those people that are right here? When I was involved with that kind of stuff years ago, with drugs and all, I knew where the drugs were. I knew where. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I could very. But now it's hard to even find who would need that kind of help. You're so far removed from all that.
Yeah, you know,
I just wonder how we as a church can make ourselves more well known that we have ministries, and what ones do we really need to expand on to help you in this corner?
We do at the county, we try to really stay on top of what the churches are doing. So it may not seem like, but there's a lot of attention to what the churches in the community are doing, and we reach out to churches when we see a need that we think they can fill. So when we need space to do something, we call the local church. There's a couple of really strong faith-based institutions up in the northern part of the county that help out a lot. They store things for foster parents. They keep diapers and things for families that need them, and families can just go there and get them. I follow Mary Hoyer's email really closely. I actually just sent her an email to request that I asked her. I don't know if she'll say yes or not. But I asked her to email blast all of her contacts on her church email list to try to collect every vacation Bible school and summer camp and youth group event that's going to be happening this summer all over the county so that we can share that with families who are going to be looking for activities for the kids and for stuff to do this summer that doesn't cost a lot of money. But as far as, because this is a question that people, they ask me a lot, it's amazing to me. It's easy to miss people if you're not looking. And I guess what I would recommend, if you really want to see people who are hurting, you can't drive. You need to walk, I would say. But I think if you walk down any main street in any one of our towns and just look, and look for the people, you know. People look tired. They look sad. They have kids that look tired and look sad. And other than that, I mean, as far as, like, you know, so this is for me, too. Like, I'm growing here, too. Like, I spent, like, so much of my life trying to figure out the best way to share the gospel, and I just am past that. I'm just gonna say it, you know. And, you know, I think about, like, when Jesus fed the 5,000, and he looked at them, and he saw they were hungry, and he gave them food. Like, it's so simple. They're hungry, give them food. He wasn't worrying about enabling them or about, you know, creating people who are dependent. They came back the next day looking for food again, and this time he told them how to really get saved, you know? He had an audience, and a lot of people got saved. But the other thing is like, he really told people to kind of think about it. He wanted people to know that, you know, following him was a sacrifice. He wasn't selling it as, you know, just, it's all good, it's hard. It's going to be hard to follow Jesus. And I guess I've just gotten where I feel like for me personally in my Christian walk, I just say it, and we'll see what the Holy Spirit does with it, hopefully. So. That's right. It's all worth it, for sure.
But so, it's funny that they can't see in that lifestyle that lifestyle's hard. If you're losing your family, you can't, you know what I mean? Everywhere you go, you're being chased by cops, whatever.
It's just a cycle, though, you know? It's that cycle of the more pain you feel, the more you crave the stuff that's going to numb the pain, whether that's your opiate or your alcohol or your explosive violence, which is also definitely a coping skill, releases a lot of difficult energy to have a big explosive violent outburst. All that stuff comes with consequences. It increases the pressure and makes it more likely you're going to have that break again. And, you know, we've been talking about this at the Hope Center as well, there's a lot of research on childhood trauma. You know, kids that, they say, you know, your fight, flight, flee response is great if you're being chased by a bear in the woods. It's not so good if the bear comes home from work every night to your house. Just basically understanding that kids that grow up living in dangerous situations, they don't have any way to respond to the world other than to treat it like it's all dangerous. And so they fight, and they run, and they freeze. And that's a really hard coping strategy to use if you want to have a job, or you want to be a good parent, or you want to, you know, it's... these are the things, these are problems that there's a lot. You come to the Hope Center, and I'll tell you all about all the great stuff we're doing. We've got a lot of innovative stuff happening in this county. There's a lot of people who care a lot. They work really hard to bring good programs here to help people. But these are sin problems, and we need God to solve them. We need salvation for people. So, you know, I've had some, there's some kind of specific needs in the county that I think would be great needs for the churches to fill. And I can email them to you, Pastor Kenya, and there's a couple that I've been thinking about. You know, one of the things that I think would be great for churches to do is to take meals when people are homeless, because we do have homeless people in Allegheny County, and they're homeless with their children. And just what a blessing it would be to get a meal when you're living in a hotel with your kids and you have only a microwave to cook. There's a couple of other things that I can email, but I would just say, Dave, you get out there, you know, get out there and see people, you know, because they're out there. There's a lot of Christians that I work with, and we pray together, and we have for a long time. I personally, when I'm going to speak with people, I pray. I ask for compassion and I ask for wisdom to say the right words. But as far as like how to actually do the job, in social services, we dot I's and we cross T's. We're just very careful. And we look at what we know and then we pick it apart and then we put it back together. And I think one of the things about child welfare that can be pretty misunderstood is that people believe that child welfare can just go remove children. Like the kids are, it's dangerous, go remove them. It's not like that. Families have due process, they have rights, they have lawyers. And kind of similar to the criminal justice system, any movement by child welfare, if you're going to intervene in the relationship between a parent and a child, you have to be able to prove in front of a judge with evidence that that's necessary. And so, I mean, sometimes there's nothing you can do, not because you don't believe that a child's in a bad situation, but just because you don't have the evidence to prove it. So, I mean, but I really don't want to make things sound like they're all bad, because the truth is that the huge majority of the time, people want good things for their kids. We're not living surrounded by people who want to hurt their children. That's just contrary to what it means to be a parent. We live surrounded by people who lack resources, and people who have addiction, and people who've had bad examples of relationships. And when they understand that there's an impact on their kids, they want to change it almost all the time. So then it's the, trying to figure out the magical formula that'll make that happen. So.
I think we're going to say we need to spend some time praying. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.